This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. American-born Kaiser Guo was one of the godfathers of Chinese rock. The son of Chinese immigrants co-founded the band Tung Dynasty, and that was in the late 1980s. The group brought the long-haired, head-banging metal aesthetic to the Chinese music scene, and it merged metal and traditional Chinese sound that actually forged something quite unique. The band exploded in popularity in China. Their music video landed on TV screens through MTV, and after Tung Dynasty, Kaiser went on to play Chinese metal with his band Spring and Autumn. From there, life and music, he changed, actually. Switched from music to becoming a writer whose documents the culture and political scene in China. He's the host of the popular Seneca podcast, which explores Chinese current affairs. He works on that podcast right here in North Carolina. Kaiser, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
You grew up in upstate New York, right? Son of Chinese immigrants. Talk about what those early days looked like for you.
I had a pretty contemptibly blissful childhood. My folks, like you said, they had come actually from mainland China via Taiwan. They had spent some years there after 1949, and both had come to the United States in the mid-1950s. They met in Ohio and got married in Berkeley, where my dad was doing his doctorate. And they had a slew of kids. We had a terrific suburban upbringing. Nothing to complain about from childhood. weren't tiger parents.
Well, why did they came here? I mean, there was something about American values, American virtues, or it was just convenient. Why did they choose?
Yeah, I think my father had a fixation with America from a very early age. I mean, he was watching the American volunteer group, the legendary Flying Tigers, doing battle with Japanese fighters over the skies of the town he grew up in Chongqing it was called back then. Yeah. I was really fond of Americans.
And in terms of your growing up in upstate New York then, 70s, 80s, what was that like for you as the child of immigrants, as a Chinese-American, son of immigrant family?
It was great. I think we lived in a really small kind of an IBM community in upstate New York in a town called Apalachin, which is really only famous for one thing, for having hosted this big mafia convention in the late 1950s. But it was a terrific place. I think, we experienced very little by way of racism. In fact, it was so soaked in, like, the good American civic virtues. There's a story I like to tell because I was witness to it. I mean, one evening, the very day my parents had been naturalized as U.S. citizens, the doorbell rang during dinner, and I hopped up and went and answered it. And there was our whole neighborhood. They had turned out, with flags and drums, and they were just, singing patriotic songs. And they just marched our family around the neighborhood in a impromptu parade.
Well, that's great. Interestingly enough, the tensions that you experienced were within the Chinese community, pro-Taiwan, pro-mainland tensions within Chinese communities, huh?
That's very, very much correct. In 1972, after the Nixon and Kissinger visits to China, there was a real schism. There were people who supported recognition of mainland China over Taiwan. Taiwan had the seat in the UN at the time and had U.S. recognition as the Republic of China. And that was obviously, going to change. My parents sided on the mainland side despite their years in Taiwan. And that was a controversial decision. The whole community was really sort of divided down the middle.
Had those divisions been evident before the question of, that was always a question, but not taken seriously until that visit. Had those divisions been evident before then?
There were some. I mean, in the 1960s, there were some on sort of radical fringe who supported what was happening in the Cultural Revolution, I think out of ignorance more than anything else. But my parents, I think even before the Nixon-Kissinger visit, they tended to lean a bit left. My father, only a few years after that, he went to China in 1975. I don't think the schism was really out in the open until, like the mid-1970s. But it was very clear. We came under a lot of pressure because of that.
It's interesting because when you think about a diaspora like that, that particularly those who leave during a revolution or during times of radical change like that, there is a tendency to have nothing to do with that government that replaced, the one that chased you out or was the cause of your leaving. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, you think about Cuban refugees,
for instance.
Yeah. There was no sympathy, I think, very little sympathy in Florida among Cubans for for Castro.
That's right. I think part of it, it's got to be a function, I think, of sort of, you know, a young person's rebellion. Both sets of grandparents had ties to the Kuomintang, to the Chinese nationalist regime in Taiwan. And I think both of my parents were sort of in their phases of youthful rebellion, and they took the other position.
Your family ended up moving to Tucson, though, Arizona.
That's right.
Partly as a result of that, right?
Yeah, I think my dad took a job, an opportunity to transfer to Tucson, in part to get my mom away from New York City, where, you know, she had gotten, you know, pretty wrapped up with a bunch of pretty nutty leftists.
Yeah, and word was out.
Yeah, we were getting, you know, like the occasional threatening call.
So that was many of your formative years now growing up in Tucson. What was that like for you? And was that where you developed your love for music?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think in 1978 was the year that I moved. And I moved into, you know, the friends that I made were basically these, you know, motorcycle riding, pot smoking, heavy metal listening kids. And, you know, I got pretty deeply imprinted with that stuff. And so, yeah, it was a good period for that. You know, bands like Judas Priest were really active.
And what about you in music? Your parents supportive of your because you started to play. Was this when you started to play music yourself?
Yeah, a couple of years after that, I'd picked up guitar. They were incredibly supportive. They never really stopped me from doing anything. I'd have to defend. I'd have to sit down and, you know, talk through Rush lyrics with Dad to explain to him why they were, you know, why there was something, you know, of merit.
Well,
to
maybe
them.
You could spend a minute with me on that.
But
go ahead.
They actually were incredibly supportive. In fact, when I had the world's worst high school band, we practiced in my living room once, and all our, you know, noise caused the family's, or my folks' wedding china and crystal to come crashing down off of a shelf. And my mom just sort of laughed about it. She tells the story way too many times now, but she was, you know, pretty enlightened.
She was okay.
She was okay with you wrecking their china.
You went off to college and studied politics at UC Berkeley. What were you planning to do?
I guess I had my eyes set initially. I mean, I thought, like all boys, you know, intelligence or the State Department. And then I suppose toward the end there, I thought a life in academia might be suitable for me. But I spent, when I wasn't in the books, I was playing in a band. And the band was, I mean, music was a big thing for me then in college. And I was pretty dead set on going to China to play at some point.
We are talking with the producer of the Seneca podcast today. His name is Kaiser Kuo, and he is with us today on The State of Things. Well, so talk about that now. When you actually went to China, you went to Beijing, right?
I did, yeah. So my folks had a home there. They had set up the household there, and my grandmother lived there. So it was a pretty safe place. It was the city I liked best in China. It was, you know, the form of Chinese I had learned, and I had an instant liking for the place.
And what year was this?
That was in 1988. I'd been there before. Mm-hmm. I was there in 1981 when I was only 15, again in 86 when I was in college. But then right after graduating, I went there in 88. Yeah. In college, I'd played in a band that had been invited to go to China to play. That didn't end up happening for reasons I'm not going to get into. But the band broke up, you know, as bands do. But I was just burning with this idea. You know, I'd been the one arranging our tour in China. So I knew they had backline gear. They had gear that they would only have if there were rock bands there. So I figured I'm going to find them. There was no internet. There was nothing in any of the magazines in the library about, you know, a rock scene in China. I knew that Wham! UK had gone there. You know, George Michael, he had gone there to play. I knew that Genesis, had actually a band that I really liked back then, had played one show in far southern China. But that was it.
So the equipment had to be there because those backup bands and those warm-up bands, they all had to have something. But the question is, what was the scene at the time? Remember, you're talking about mid to late 80s, so things are opening up now. There's a lot more interest, I guess, in Western culture. Describe the scene there.
Well, prior to that, really, I mean, if you had asked anyone what their knowledge of Western music was, it was limited to the Carpenters, which were just inexplicably popular in China at the time. Although, I mean, I love Karen Carpenter's voice and everything. She's a lovely singer. And John Denver, who I actually saw once in a hotel in Xi'an, recognizing him for the bluebird sitting on his shoulders and squirrels and small forest animals. He's a lovely
man. Which he brings with him, apparently.
Right, he brings with him, yeah. or they followed him around.
So there was an appetite. What about rock at this point?
So,
I'm wondering how a guy from the United States can be the godfather of rock and roll in 1988 in China.
So I don't think I was the godfather. That's I mean, maybe of metal, but of rock, there was the guy who's the indisputable godfather. He was already quite active. His name was Cui Jian, or is Cui Jian. He's a phenomenal musician and a real, you know, spirit. I mean, he's sort of, people compare him to Dylan and Bruce Springsteen, and has a voice sort of like Mark Knopfler's. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, he's got chops, and he's an amazing guy and real passion.
And already had a reputation.
Yeah, he had a reputation.
Time and a bit of a following.
Yeah, quite one by 88, for sure. And, but there were other musicians who were playing like harder rock, and I managed to meet some of them pretty early on.
We'll find out what happened when they met at a music store when we continue my conversation with Kaiser Guo. He is a Chinese rock pioneer and host of the Seneca Chinese Current Affairs podcast, and we'll continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking to Kaiser Guo. He's a Chinese rock pioneer and a prolific writer, now lives in Chapel Hill, and he hosts the podcast on Chinese affairs called Seneca. So we're talking about, you know, meeting other metalheads in China. You're in Beijing, and you go, was it a music store?
Yeah, it was a music store. A Russian friend of mine had actually tipped me off to it, and I went with another American kid who I knew from the school I was enrolled in. That was my sort of cover, how I'd gotten to China, got a student visa. This guy, his name was Sean, he was from Arkansas, and the two of us wandered down to this music store, and the floor manager insisted that we plug in and play before we could talk about, you know, renting some gear to try to start a band. We drew in a big crowd off the street. We were playing just, you know, the oeuvre of just kind of 1970s, you know, AOR, as they used to call it, right? Boston and Blue Oyster Cult and Black Sabbath, just for the Bs, AC/DC or whatever. Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and Rush. Had a really good time, and all these people sort of wandered in off the street, and then the manager kind of comes out, and he's this kind of roly-poly, oily guy with bedizened in all sorts of 24-karat gold jewelry, just to let you know he's the boss. And he has a real stern expression. I'm pretty sure he's going to kick us out for you know, bringing in all these uncouth people from the street to gawk at us. But instead, he actually pulls us into the back, and after this real ceremony where he produces, you know, a bottle of Chinese liquor and cigars, and, you know, without saying a word, he's slowly lighting our cigars and long pregnant pauses, and finally says, can this guy speak Chinese? I said, well, a little. Will you translate? I said, sure. He said, how would you like to be on stage performing next week? And so I told Sean, who's, like I said, from Arkansas, and I'll try to do his accent, but he said, I translated it, and Sean says, Kaiser, you tell a man hell yeah, you tell him hell yeah. So I did, and he made good on it. We were on stage next week, but first he introduced us to a local musician who really changed my life. This guy's name was Ding Wu, and he summoned him, you know, he beeped him. We had pagers back then, and came to this restaurant across the street where I met him, and it was one of those, you know, meetings that just altered the course of things.
How so? What happened?
So he's just a remarkable guy. I mean, he's maybe worth describing because, you know, he's the lead singer of Tang Dynasty, and only recently has just dissolved the band and gone on to other things. But He was a guy with gifted with a really, you know, incredibly high kind of operatic voice. Just physically striking guy, 6'2 or so, really long hair, hair to his waist. Kind of a physiognomer would have a ball with this guy. He's a really odd face for a Chinese person. You know, really large nose, among other things, which is sort of strange. He was a really talented guitarist, as we found out later when, after, you know, getting just rip-roaring drunk, we piled into this little, like, impromptu cab and made it to this factory on the outskirts of town where their band had stored all their gear and was able to play on this factory floor during the evening shifts all the way until morning.
So Tang Dynasty was already a thing?
No. This was a different band. They were playing in a band which was not really a band. It was kind of a collective of musicians. They were like 17 people, which was, you know, we thought it was odd when they were asking us to join this band that already had like five guitarists. But anyway, so I stripped Dingwu away from that band and we formed Tang Dynasty together.
I'll talk more about that, about the band itself, the aesthetic. I mean, where do you start? You just did what you wanted to do? Or?
Well, we actually had to think quite a bit about this. I mean, the aesthetic, I mean, it came kind of naturally. Dingwu already looked, I mean, he looked like he'd been ripped from the pages of a kung fu comic novel. I mean, he was, you know, he had kind of heroic proportions. And so that really sparked this idea, you know, of the band is we were all sort of these tall, long-haired northern boys, and we had... a kind of ready touchstone to reach for. You know how in the West, beginning with Zeppelin, and I mean, there was always sort of this Tolkien or medieval sort of fantasy touchstone for. There was an analogy in China, which was what they call the wuxia novels, these martial arts epics, and it mapped really well onto it, right? Because, you know, metal is so much about virtuosity, about chops, you know, to a fault. Like kung fu is, right? You know, martial arts are all about who instructed you in this technique and how good you are at this or that. So it really mapped well, and we kind of went with that aesthetic, and we you know, went with the, you know, to the point where at one point we were actually thinking about taking to the stage wearing, you know, with our hair tied up in those kind of traditional
top knots.
Yeah.
Well, so talk about taking the stage and Tang Dynasty's impact on the Chinese music scene.
Oh, I mean, you know, you don't want to blow your own horn too much, but it was big. We sold, I guess the numbers, some people say it was 2 million official, but there were hundreds of different pirated versions of it. And so everyone had it. It was hard to for a while there to get into a cab without hearing your own music, which was really strange. Yeah. And this was a music that was so utterly alien to China. So we'd come up with kind of a device to make it work, a kind of vehicle. And part of it is the name itself, but also just working kind of recognizably Chinese elements into the music.
Well, like, well, we'll talk about the significance of Tang Dynasty.
So the Tang, it was a dynasty that lasted from about 618 to 907 AD. And generally, it's regarded as one of the most successful Chinese dynasties. It was, you know, a great dynasty. It was the time where people associate it with the great poetry. Still, people memorize poetry from that era. But it was great because it was cosmopolitan. That's something that people kind of know. They take as a given. So when reform and opening was happening, that was it was very much in the air. People were talking about greatness through openness. And, you know, you could be... a Chinese person and proud of your Chinese identity and still actively want to absorb learnings from abroad. And so we thought that was a good vehicle for to make it work. So people kind of implicitly, whether they thought about it or not, they understood that that there was a kind of cosmopolitan layer on it.
What were the Chinese elements that you felt were important to keep in this so that you didn't seem too alien?
So some of it is instrumentation. Some of it is the lyrics, you know, just drawing on kind of the poetic themes, the very imagistic approach to lyric writing of the time. I had no hand in the lyrics. It was all Dingwu. And, you know, he had help as well. But me, my contributions were, for some reason, I discovered... that you could play a lot of pentatonic stuff that was blues, basically without a blues note. And it would sound very Chinese, like playing all the black keys on a piano, that you could come up with, you know, an infinite number of melodies that were based on, you know, a pentatonic scale, and that you could use just basic fourths and fifths, the intervals, and make it sound very kind of at once recognizably Chinese and quite like martial and metal and kind of hard. So that was my contribution to it.
Yeah, and again, you're staying within the scale. You don't have to go to a chromatic progressions and
yeah,
and
we did too. I mean, just to show that we weren't limited.
That's good. Right. But no, at some point, and I don't know if this was with this band or some earlier point, but somebody promoted you as Michael Jackson's backup group.
Oh my God! Yeah. You've given the punchline away for a pretty funny story, but So in 1988, of course, we started this band. I guess we started it in 89, and it was we were writing our material and rehearsing during the student demonstrations of 1989. In fact, my best friend from college, who was the drummer of the band I played in college, he had come out to China on the very day that the student demonstrations really began, or that the event that sparked them happened, the death of a former party general secretary named Hu Yaobang. On the day he died, my friend arrived. Then we started, you know, rehearsing and writing material. So we were dividing our time between the square and there. But on the morning of June 3rd, so like 16 hours or so before the shooting started, we left to go on tour. We didn't know what was happening. And we didn't know either that we had been promoted. This was a second band, which was this guy Sean, who I'd mentioned earlier, Kaiser Teleman, Hell Yes. He, me and my friend Drew, we were in this little band called Short Term Gratification, STG, which was really our motto at the time. And we had been promoted as Michael Jackson's backup band, but when we actually got to our final destination, because Sean had feuded with the promoter and left and gone back to Beijing, there was nobody in the front who looked remote, you know, plausibly like he could have been Michael Jackson. They were Chinese guys, including myself. And so they rioted. The audience burned down the ticket booth, demanded their money back. They tried to, you know, get us. The security forces had to, like, protect us and, you know, moved us to a hotel where we were, like, under guard.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what were you planning to do? I mean, so if Sean had been there, Hell Yes-ing him to death, proving he was Michael Jackson's guy or something.
Well, we didn't know. We didn't
know.
Oh, you
didn't know. That, right. So that's what, so you didn't
know.
We
were wondering why the violence, and they finally confessed to us that we had said.
I see.
Let's go. So that's what you get for not reading Chinese, because I didn't know that was, you know.
That was part of the deal. Well, I wonder how long they thought they'd get away with it. Anyway, you did manage to get through that, and then there is the music that you created with Tang Dynasty. The band's debut album sold over 2 million copies.
They say, yeah. I have no idea what.
So would that make you big? I mean, were you like a celebrity in everywhere, or just certain cities, only in the urban areas?
Urban areas, yeah. Mainly. Yeah, those guys, yeah. I mean, we're pretty recognizable for a while. But, you know, again, it's a different kind of thing. It's not like celebrity in the West. I mean, you weren't mobbed by people all the time.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the music that we've been talking about. This is Epic by Tang Dynasty. Just a little sample of Epic, Tang Dynasty. My guest, Kaiser Guo, who is the co-founder of that Chinese metal band and also host of the Chinese Current Affairs podcast, Seneca. So what were you thinking at that point? This is going to be your career? Because you were also going to grad school, weren't you? Or had that started yet?
I hadn't started yet. It started in 89 after I went sort of tumbling out of China. I couldn't really stay. I had planned on staying at least another year. We had been cast in a movie. I was cast for another film. So it looked like things were going to be a lot of fun, and I was going to stay in China for a couple of years. But I left on and started grad school a little sooner than I had anticipated.
It was Tiananmen Square, any
part
of that?
Yeah, it was Tiananmen Square, yeah. That was a big part of that. I mean, the U.S. consulate, when they finally tracked us down, insisted that we leave. They said, you know, you'll be first against the wall.
Great to hear that from your own government.
Exactly. So, it was a bit of an exaggeration.
So talk about what happens now. Grad school, what are your choices there?
So I actually, you know, I went to grad school for an embarrassingly long time, but escaped during the summers and went back and rejoined the band and, you know, wrote more material with them, recorded demos with them. Then finally in 92, just made the decision, I'm just going to pull the plug. I'm not going to. I'm going to just stick to my studies. But I was pulled back in 1996. In 95, our bass player had been killed in a motorcycle accident. And, you know, in a very standard kind of band dynamic, he was like the nice, affable guy who could keep the lead guitarist and lead singer from killing one another. Mm-hmm. And so once he was gone, they started trying to kill one another. Mm-hmm. And the lead singer, who's Dingwu, who I had met in that music store, he asked me to come back to China to rejoin the band. At that point, I had actually, you know, cut my hair short, and I was trying to be serious, and, you know, was
studying what? What were your plans, grad school?
I was working on modern intellectual history. I was beginning at that time work on a dissertation about the emergence of technocrats in post-Mao China. Really, it was the least metal thing imaginable.
So you've got that going for you.
Yeah.
96, the plea to come back, and you do.
And I do. I do. I mean, it was hard. I mean, it was like terrible recidivism, but I did. I went back. And at first, I tried to just, you know, cajole them into, you know, staying together in the band that I had left. I mean, they had this guitarist who was so much better than me at that point. He was, you know, he was just this crazily great, you know, frenetic, fast player and just chops monster. And I couldn't compare to him. I was always somebody of really middling talents who was only, I had landed on a low gravity planet, essentially. Mm. I mean, my chops wouldn't have gotten me anywhere in America.
Or China in 1996, maybe.
Or 96, exactly.
So,
by then, right.
But you're there, and a few years later, 99, really, the band did break up.
We did break. Well, I left the band. It was one of those, you know, I broke up with you before you broke up with me. But no, I did leave the band, but yeah. It was clear that I was no longer welcome.
But what was it like? What were you imagining for yourself at the time? Because again, now you've begun this intellectual career. You're starting to write these less than metal type papers, but you're in this band, and the band is still doing well, right?
Right. So I had a lot of choices. It was really tough. I actually sat down the night that I left the band. The band broke up because of, or I was, our troubles really culminated with the embassy bombing, of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, Yugoslavia.
By the Allied forces, the U.S., the United States. This was during the war against Serbia, the Kosovo War, right?
And
the U.S. was claiming it was an accident.
Exactly. And I was taking that line, too. I was quite sure. I mean, I would try to translate as best I could. I said, if it's between conspiracy and stupidity, go with stupidity. You know, that was my explanation. I said, of course, I mean, ineptitude would explain this. Yeah, maybe there was signals intelligence being shared out of the embassy, but there were no Chinese people who believed that. And I was very insensitive to that. Yeah. And I think there were a lot of other things. I was this middle-class kid. I had other things I could go do. I wasn't dependent on money. So I would insist that we stay true to our artistic merits and, you know, write these ridiculous long, you know, 12-minute epics that weren't ever going to get played on the radio. And I think I made a lot of mistakes.
Talking to Kaiser Guo today on The State of Things. He is now the producer of the Seneca podcast, which is a podcast about Chinese affairs, but we're talking about his time as a musician. Also, I would guess at that moment you might, you've been sort of passing yourself as, you're obviously an American, but you're in China. I wonder if you have a sense at that moment, maybe I'm not Chinese. I mean, is there a sort of an identity issue at that moment?
You know, I had like spent my whole life before denying that there was any kind of an identity issue. I thought that I could simply be comfortably bicultural and that I would never have to choose sides, I still sort of, to an extent, believe that those choices can be put off, that I can be bicultural. But once in a while, something will just loom up and drive this stark choice home, and that was one of those moments.
And I would think too, again, because it was clear to many around the world that there was something else going on, that the United States may well have made a mistake, but the idea that that embassy may have been involved in some activities that weren't helping the Allied cause.
Not that that would have justified the bombing.
Wouldn't have justified it, but it may have been the reason that the United States didn't want to tell anybody. They would rather you all believe it was an accident. In any case, if you're in China, it sure looks like it
sure
was intentional.
Does, yeah.
And that underscores an underlying tension that may have been masked by some of this opening that had been experienced, albeit interrupted by Tiananmen Square.
That's right. I mean, U.S.-China relations were in a real deep freeze for a while after that. Just a couple of years later, there was an American reconnaissance plane, an EP-3, flying off the south coast of China, and a Chinese fighter, and a couple of Chinese fighters intercepted them. One of them was sort of hot-dogging close to the plane, clipped its wing. The Chinese fighter pilot died. The EP-3 had to land. It was a forced landing on Hainan Island in the South China Sea. And that was, yeah, the real nadir. I mean, you know, U.S.-China relations had plummeted. I mean, then September 11th happened, and everything was peachy. The U.S. was completely distracted, was enrolling China in the so-called global war on terror, and there was kind of a nice seven-year lull in that.
Chinese government happily enlisted in that, having problems with its own Western provinces.
Exactly.
And the Muslim population there. Well, let's talk more about that. U.S.-China relations, the centerpiece of your podcast, Seneca, when my conversation with Kaiser Guo continues on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Kaiser Guo is a Chinese-American rocker and founder of China's first heavy metal band, Tung Dynasty. He's also, the band skyrocketed to fame, in fact. And then in 1999, Kaiser made the transition to life in the tech world as a writer and a consultant, also a former international communications director for Baidu, the Google of China. And today he hosts the podcast on Chinese Affairs that is called Seneca.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I'm in Washington, D.C. today. Joining me from the rustic splendor of Goldcorn Holler is a man whose head-turning physical beauty really puts the 10 in Tennessee, Mr. Jeremy Goldcorn.
There we go. There's a little bit of a sample. Tell us more about this transition. Well, tell about putting the podcast together. Where'd that come from? The idea come from?
Yeah, so I started it with my old dear friend, Jeremy Goldcorn, who's a South African who'd been kicking around in China for almost as long as I had. Oh, longer, in fact. He had been there in 94 or 5, a year or two before I arrived. Speaks really good Chinese. Was somebody who was, you know, kind of a media entrepreneur. He had started various websites and consulting things. But the two of us were just having a beer one night and said, this was in the year 2010. The iPhone had just come out not too long ago. Podcasts were starting to get big. And we were talking about what podcasts we listened to. And then I think I can't remember who it was that wondered aloud, why aren't there any good ones on contemporary affairs in China, on current affairs in China? And we decided to make one there and then. And just a week later, we went into a friend's studio and sat down with a third person, the guest, and talked about Google's pullout from China in January 2010.
And you have, and your audience is, who are you aiming for?
So it's a mixed bag. There were sort of the professional China watcher types. There's a lot of people in the intelligence community at the State Department in think tanks who listen to us. But then a lot of sort of amateur China watchers, is people who are interested in, and then just news consumers, a lot of graduate student types, the academics. But it's good. You know, we do a couple hundred thousand downloads a month.
You were, before that, I think, penning a column for about 10 years in a publication called The Beijinger, right?
That's right, yeah. That was just, I mean, that's nothing to talk about. It was called Ich bin ein Beijinger, which is, yeah. I grew up with a lot of Kennedy.
That's a lot of culture in there.
Yeah, so Ich bin ein Beijinger was kind of a cross-cultural smart aleck column. I mean, yeah. It was a lot of just very kind of funny doggerel, or it was supposed to be funny. I'm not sure I succeeded in being funny. I was satirical mostly, but, you know, once in a while I'd do a little piece of very, very short fiction just about life in Beijing, kind of viewed through a cross-cultural or a bicultural person.
You know, it's got to be important for all of us to understand what's going on in China, to then understand what our relationship is and what it would mean to all of us. Obviously, that's important. But for Americans, particularly isolated Americans who barely understand what's going on in Canada and Mexico, to understand a complicated culture that goes back so far and has so much diversity, it would seem to me, I mean, even for you as an American who grew up American and spent a lot of time in China, a pretty difficult thing to get a handle on.
That's absolutely right. I mean, for me, I mean, I had this sort of moment where I decided to go to grad school. It was after Tiananmen Square, and I had realized that there was this whole hidden language, even though I could understand sort of ordinary conversational Chinese, but there was a whole layer that was going on that I couldn't possibly understand, references to historical events and personages. Mm-hmm. I just didn't know. There was this whole semiotics that was mysterious to me, and that's kind of why I decided to take it seriously. Explaining it to Americans has been kind of my mission ever since. I think I've always been very mission-driven, and that's, I think, what I do best. I've done it the other way around, trying to explain Americans popular culture, say, to my Chinese friends, but I think I'm more effective the other way.
Well, talk about some of the misconceptions, the greatest that you encounter most often.
My God, I'm not sure where to start. I guess part of the problem, of course, is that we see it almost entirely, except for those few of us who were lucky enough to have spent much time there. Our understanding of China is entirely shaped by our media. And as excellent as the media has a very different mission, I think, or it ought to, when it comes to foreign reporting than it does in writing about things more familiar to us. I think that we need to spend a bit of time and understand the optical properties of this lens that we're seeing China through. I don't think that it's malicious. I don't think that there's this grand conspiracy to malign China or anything like that. I think it's just mostly structural.
Well, and I'm wondering about the other way around, too, trying to understand the West. If you're going to now participate as one of the big players in global capitalism, then there is a cultural understanding that it seems to me you need to, that for China, there had to be an acceleration in understanding how the West thinks, because a lot of this came from the West.
That's absolutely right. I think that China is equally, if not even more, guilty of not understanding the lenses through which it views the United States. Many of them are deeply ideological. A lot of them are filled with sort of age-old resentments. That's something, it's a given. I mean, if the United States media is problematic. My God, look at the Chinese media. So no, I'm not assigning blame to one side.
Well, it's not even blame. It's just trying to fathom this, because we're going to talk about a couple of particular issues. We can start with tariffs, for instance. So we can read the headlines, and it sort of maps on our consciousness as, you know, two powerful entities going head to head, trying to get some kind of economic advantage. I mean, that, and so they're shouting at each other. And if you don't do this, I'll do that. Oh yeah, well, watch this. We can understand it in that kind of a playground bully dynamics, but there's so much more going on.
That's
and
right.
So much that each side doesn't know about the other that makes this seem not only more difficult, but actually kind of dangerous.
I agree completely. I think that what's always needed is more context. We don't always have the leisure of and that's part of why Jeremy and I decided to start that podcast, was that we'd give people a full hour to unspool all the complicated, you know, contextual things that get left by the wayside, all those pieces that end up on the cutting room floor when you edit a story, when we're talking to a reporter. We need more time to explain. We don't have that leisure in a couple column inches in a story or in a 2-minute NPR piece.
How is this being perceived? Let's say the fight over tariffs in China, particularly in let's say some of the more urban areas where people are making money, moving into the middle class. What's the perception of this fight among that population in China?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. And again, it's really hard to say. I think that there are a lot of people in China who are maybe surprisingly awake to the unfairness with which China has engaged in a lot of this trade competition. I think there are also a lot of people who understand that they have maybe a sophisticated understanding of the economics at work here, and says, you know, the United States is better be careful what it wishes for, because if it's not running a current account deficit with China, if China is not piling up all this money, who's going to buy the T-notes at the Fed auction? Mm-hmm. That, you know, the American savings rate is simply abysmally low. The Chinese savings rate may be too high, dangerously high. But that is what is driving this. It's not, you know, just overcapacity in steel production. I think that the Chinese view is also that they're looking at the United States and understanding that this you're experiencing an anxiety because you've never faced a peer competitor before. Mm-hmm. And here we are feeling very much, you know, China is feeling it, so it's feeling very much in its power these days. It has come off 40 years of near double-digit growth, and it feels like it has every right to reclaim a sort of historical place in the world, at least in that region. And it feels very much that that the United States is trying to keep it down. Right. Now, whether that is a correct assessment of it or not is irrelevant. It's, I think, what we need to look at, as you very, very wisely did, is what is the Chinese perception?
Right. And understanding, too, that it's very hard even for average Americans, and there are some, the wealth of voters here who can't quite get that if you impose a tariff on that foreign-made product, it will raise prices here.
That's right.
And a lot of those products go into even things that are made here in the United States or finally built here in the United States from parts that come from abroad. So if you can't get that part, which is actually pretty simple, it's going to come on a boat from someplace else and cost you more. If you can't get that part, then think about T-notes and all the rest of it and balance of trade. So it's fascinating to watch these conversations take place, particularly in a place like China, where this new emerging middle class and wealthy class is now. How has that changed cultural life and the sense of values and norms in a place like China?
Yeah, I wish I could be more sanguine about it, but the fact is the sort of madcap breakneck, you know, get rich the last however many years, it has in many ways really put a strain on traditional values, but even on values. It's made China into a very low trust society. There's a sort of ethic of brutal me-first pragmatism, and it's not pretty. I think it's a place where there's very little sort of trust among individuals that makes it difficult to even do something as simple as making friends, or mm-hmm. there's a suspicion always. It reminds me of the Gilded Age in the United States.
Yeah, things look good to people, so nobody asks too many questions, and then you finally get to this stage that we're at the United States, where you're out of room to grow, and then you have to look around and say, what have we lost? What did we give up in the process of that? It's social networks. It's a kind of sense of trust. It's a bond that hasn't been mediated by a bank. You know, that the idea that we could actually trust each other to make this thing work, all gone, and we didn't notice because we were so busy thinking things were getting better.
That's right.
And they weren't. So you're in that moment. But talk about this thing, the social credit system that we've read so much about here, again, mostly through Western press. Talk more about that, because that seems to be a way in which old values and ideals are sort of coming to terms with this new reality.
So there is no real social credit system yet in China. And then this is part of the problem in the way that it's been reported. There are plans for one. There have been a couple of pilot programs in small cities. There are private initiatives by these individual companies. But there isn't one nationwide sort of blanket social credit system as has been imagined. We have this tendency right now to kind of run away with Orwellian nightmares about China. There is a lot of what you'd call techno-authoritarianism. I mean, technologies are put to use in ways that Americans would find very, very uncomfortable. But still, let's be careful about how we talk about the realities. That said, look, social credit programs, as they have been introduced, for example, by these private companies, aren't so different from, say, loyalty programs. I mean, people actually are trying to sort of up their numbers because it affords them discounts on things, lower interest rates when they apply for microloans. It affords them access to services that they wouldn't otherwise be able to get if they had low credit scores. We have credit mm-hmm. scoring systems as well.
Well, and we punish people for paying their bills on time. We punish people for, you know, sort of some of the other offenses. It's the public shaming part of it that seems a little different. But
right.
Punishing people for failing to live up to their responsibility is
now,
what we do.
If it were implemented in the way that has been maybe in the most extreme versions of it, of course it would be absolutely an intolerable, intrusive, and frankly very Orwellian system. But we're not nearly there yet. Mm-hmm. And so far, a lot of these pilot programs actually have met with enough resistance that they've shut them down. I don't think that, yeah.
Talking today with Kaiser Kuo on the state of things. He is the producer of the Seneca podcast, lives right here in Chapel Hill. Talk about that decision to come to North Carolina and live in Chapel Hill.
So in 2000, some years ago, my wife and I had decided that the one thing we could do for our children that would be pretty effortless would be to give them a bicultural upbringing. So they had attended grade school in China, which was, I thought was really good. I mean,
you met your wife.
I met my wife in Beijing. Mm-hmm. She's a Beijinger. She doesn't really speak English. So we had a naturally kind of bicultural household. They both speak very good English and excellent Chinese. We wanted to preserve that. So we wanted to come to the States for the second half of their education so they could really, you know, get in touch with their American roots. I happen to believe that just the pedagogical system of China just fails to serve people well after sixth grade. It's just teaching to, you know, a college entry test after that. Fortunately, I didn't have to move to the San Francisco Bay Area. I went to college there and I like it, but my old company, Baidu, was going to move me there. Along came this little media company called SubChina out of New York. Wonderful people, a great mission, very aligned with what we were doing with Seneca, and they bought us, gave me and Jeremy jobs, and allowed us to live anywhere on the East Coast we wanted, basically Eastern time zone.
So what was it about Chapel Hill?
So what it was about Chapel Hill was many things. It ticked all the boxes. What we wanted was a university cluster. And with that comes, you know, lots of other good bonuses, mm-hmm. like a rich cultural life. We wanted a place with excellent public schools, with affordable housing, with nice natural scenery. And I wanted, it was 2016, I wanted to be in a place where my vote would matter. Where I could actually throw myself into the politics and maybe make a difference. And so this state and this particular community were perfect in that way.
You said affordable housing. You're coming from the Bay Area.
That's right. That's right.
But, and you also got involved in registering voters.
Right away. I got kicked out of a Trader Joe's parking lot. Like, it was one of my first experiences there for registering voters. When the cop rolled up to you know, tell me to leave, I asked him, "Are you registered to vote, officer?"
What about for your wife? What's been the difficult transition for her?
I don't think it's been. I mean, she's obviously handicapped in terms of the language mm-hmm. here, but she delights in this place. I mean, she's made lots of friends. It's a terrific Chinese community here. You know, this is a dream come true in a lot of ways, to have a garden to work and to have, you know, a house to put together. And she's really loving it here. She's very. She loves the natural surroundings, goes hiking constantly. She's quite in love with the area.
Kaiser Kuo is a Chinese rock pioneer, host of the Seneca Chinese Current Affairs podcast, and you can find out more about him and the podcast at our website, stateofthings.org. Kaiser, thanks so much for being on the
Thank you, Frank.
State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus, as well as Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director, North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.